The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmn.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from Master Wu Men's Gateless Gate. Case 13, Dishan carries his bowls. The main case. Dishan one day came down to the dining room carrying his bowls. Shui Feng said, "Old master, the bell is not rung. The drum has not yet been struck. Where are you going with your bowls?" Dishan at once turned back to the room, his room. Shui Feng told this incident to Yanto, who remarked, "Great master though he is, Dishan has not yet grasped the last word of Zen." Hearing of this, Dishan sent his attendant to call Yanto and asked him, "Do you not approve of me?" Yanto whispered his reply to him. Dishan was satisfied and silent. The next day, Dishan laughed heartily, clapping his hands and said, "What a great joy it is. The old master has now grasped the last word of Zen. From now on, nobody in the world can ever make light of him." Commentary. As for the last word of Zen, neither Yanto nor Dishan has ever heard of it, even in a dream. If I examine this carefully, they're like puppets set on a shelf. The poem. If you understand the first word of Zen, you will know the last word of Zen. The last word or the first word, it is not a word. Good morning. So we've been doing an introductory retreat this weekend with many of the folks online, some of you here. And because of the ice storm, the internet has been sort of off and on again, and it's now off again. So those of you who attended the retreat and may be listening to this later, sorry you're not here with us at the moment. So studying the Buddha Dharma, studying the Eightfold Path, there are many ways we can speak of it. It's a path of non-attachment. It's a path of no conflict. The koan is a teaching practice upaya, a skillful means in the Zen tradition to free us, help free ourselves of self-clinging, of our attachments, of clinging to others, of grasping at our conceptual mind, which we all come into practice just having a basic trust in our thinking mind and our thoughts. In experiencing emptiness, the koan helps us to let go of clinging to that. It helps us to let go of clinging to clinging. Their purpose is the purpose of the Dharma itself, which is to really free us of everything that we would try to find a place in, an identity and a self in. To untie the knot in our mind. And all of those ways of speaking about the practice that speak to the obstructions, the hindrances, the entanglements, the suffering. You know, we should understand that in every utterance, that really what we're talking about is the affirmation of life, the happiness, the joy, the peace, the contentment, the satisfaction that we seek. It's not just about putting an end to suffering. It's about bringing forth all that is good. And to do this in such a way that it is direct, experiential, transformative. It's not just a conversation piece. It's not a task set before us. It's not something we should do. That Roshi used to speak of a spiritual imperative. When it is that, When something is an imperative in our life, we tend to make it to do what we need to do to bring that about. In this koan, these three persons, Taishan, Joyfung, and Yanto, were living together, practicing together. Taishan was the teacher, and this is 8th, 9th century China. So Yanto and Joyfung were Dharma brothers practicing together, Dharma siblings. Yanto was the younger of the two, but he was a little more clear than Joyfung. And in this, Joyfung is the tenzo, so he's in the kitchen. And so one day, Yanto comes down with his bowls, Warioki, prepared to eat. And Joyfung says, "Where are you going, old man? The drum hasn't sounded, the bell hasn't rung. It's not time." And Taishan just simply turned back, went to his seat. And so this koan is really taking this just simple encounter that developed a bit as a way to examine something fundamental. Everyday experiences from the Buddhist perspective are never apart from the fundamental. In fact, an important part of our practice is to learn how to have that trust and faith that that's so. Because when we do, then we become alive. And ordinary experiences come alive with potential, with possibility. And without even knowing or understanding or realizing, just that aliveness changes the tenor of our mind. It puts us in a different relationship with things. Right? Just think about when we, you know, when we don't have that kind of consciousness, then we just go from one thing that seems to be important to the next thing that seems to be important, and everything in between is kind of dead, right? Doesn't really matter. And so this morning we chanted, if you don't see the way, you don't see it, even while you're walking on it. When you're walking the way, you realize it's not near, it's not far. To even speak of it as being near or close is too distant. When we're deluded, it's as though we're mountains and rivers away from it. It seems far away. It seems inaccessible. It seems not you. Maybe it's that distance, that sense of being separate from something essential that is the cause of our deepest longing, our sort of existential heartache, our underlying anxiety that I think if we look carefully permeates maybe just about everything. That leads us to not feel fully alive even while we're living, to not feel like we're in intimate contact even when we feel love, to be afraid of being vulnerable towards those things that we care about. And so here at Taishan came down with his bowls prepared for his meal. And Joyfung says, "What are you doing? The bell hasn't sounded." And Taishan just simply turned around and went back to his room. And so for those working on the koan, the student working on the koan, this is the first important point. And this is considered to be a nanto koan. So in Hakuin Zenji's sort of classification of different types of koans that are dealing with different kinds of dharma or different aspects of our own entanglement, like various ways that we get entangled in words and meaning, in differentiation, that there are different koans that are trying to free us, help us free ourselves in those particular areas. And so a nanto koan, Hakuin said, are koans that are difficult. They're difficult to see. They're difficult to gain entry. And so he said, this is such a koan. And Shibayama, who was commenting on this, said about Deshan and his turning back and going back to his room, said that he stealthily goes under heaven and quietly walks on earth. So he's clearly pointing to something. Something's going on here. It seems like a very simple moment, ordinary moment. It's helpful to understand that Deshan is at this point in his latter part of his life. He's old. He's been around a long time. He's been practicing a long time. He's been teaching a long time. So he's very mature, right? He's like a ripe, soft plum. He says, on the other hand, within Deshan, he says, there's no stink of Zen. And this is a phrase that is used to point to when there is a kind of attachment to being spiritual, to being enlightened, to being somebody. That there is a smell, a kind of rancid smell that starts to come out, right? So it's clearly pointing to something else. That's not valued, right? Because that is a sign of some kind of attachment to some idea, to some kind of self. And so he says here, there's in Deshan, there's no stink of Zen. He lives with no pretension, no affectation. And this is really considered a very, a good sign. No contrivance. He says, but Xue Feng was too young to be able to understand and recognize what was happening here. And so in Deshan, hears Xue Feng's words, it's not time for the meal. What are you doing? Oh, and I was on the point of saying that Deshan in his earlier years was a very vigorous and dynamic, sometimes a very ferocious teacher. Not a teacher to take lightly, not a teacher to sort of mess around with. And so here he just simply turns around and walks back, right? Turned around by this very young student. And so the first point of the koan is, what is the mind of Deshan in this moment? What is happening here? What is Shibayama pointing to when he says he is walking stealthily under heaven and quietly upon this earth? You know, think about a moment where somebody says something, right? That with, before we even know, we've perceived as a threat to our knowledge, to our expertise, to who we are, and how quickly that arises as a defensiveness. We counter it, so we feel like there's been a thrust, so we counter thrust with our sword. We explain, we judge, we compare. In other words, we don't let it be, right? Having perceived that we have somehow lost something, we try to regain our position. And there's a lot of attention to, in practice, to seeing those moments because they're revealing something about ourselves, right? That sense of the ancient mirror that I've been talking about recently is really showing us the self is arising. We should see it. We should see it as the self arising. We should see it as a conditioned response. We should see it as a defensive response. Defending what? But we should also see it in a certain sense as a distraction. If we get too caught up, too concerned about that, we won't actually see what's more important, perhaps more important, underlying that. A distraction from what? Even now, you are walking on the way. One path, one life, one awareness, one completeness, one enlightened mind, one unhindered action, one open heart. Is that what we're being distracted from? And so, we take our seats. We turn the mind around from its incessant turning away. We turn the mind around And so we should think of this seat, it's referred to as the diamond seat, the Bodhi seat, the seat of enlightenment. We could also think of it as a seat of no more regret, of the seat of no more evasion, which is why sometimes it's a difficult seat to occupy. Because no more regret, no more evasion doesn't mean it's over. Doesn't mean it doesn't still arise. It means we are trying to bring ourselves to a place of intention, aspiration, and commitment to no longer be governed by those things. I thought of a poem that I like a lot by the poet Li Yong Li. He titled it Become Becoming. And I felt like it worked in nicely with this koan. And in this poem, Li Yong Li says, "Wait for evening, then you'll be alone. Wait for the playground to empty. Then call out those companions from your childhood. The one who closed his eyes and pretended to be invisible. The one to whom you told every secret. The one who made a world of any hiding place. And don't forget the one who listened in silence while you wondered out loud, is the universe an empty mirror? A flowering tree? Is the universe the sleep of a woman? Wait for the sky's last blue, the color of your homesickness. Then you'll know the answer. Wait for the air's first gold, that color of amen. Then you'll spy the wind's barefoot steps. Then you'll recall that story beginning with a child who strays in the woods. Waiting for evening when you're alone. Coming to this seat is going to that seat where night descends. Things become quiet. The light dims. There's not so much activity. Where the playground becomes quiet. Right? Everybody goes home. Then the companions come out. Right? The old companions, karmic companions, people, conversations, memories, actions, actions given, actions received, are karma. The companions that are always there inside, that color our mind, that put a tint on our eyes and our ears and our mind, so that when we see something, what we see is we're looking through the tint of those companions, largely unexamined, largely invisible when we don't examine them, but having a lot of force, a lot of energy. And they come out when the conversations have come to rest, when the playground has become quiet. That's when we can really see them. And that as we practice that, and as we learn how to practice this mind, how to practice these arisings, and to see them, in a sense, as companions. We could easily see them as enemies, as problems, signs of brokenness. And seeing them that way, we will meet them that way. We will meet them as adversaries. We will meet them as signs of our own brokenness. We will meet them as problems. And the Buddha basically realized that is our delusion. Seeing the world, painting the world in a broad brush of brokenness. And so as we become more and more skillful at practicing, learning how to stay in the room as those companions come to visit, not fleeing, not shutting them down, not throwing them in the closet, not muzzling, but also not taking up their own particular plaything. In a sense, as the Buddha said, letting them, with our own mindfulness, tire themselves out, exhaust themselves. And then Li Yongli says, "Now, the sky's last blue, the air's first gold. Now we begin to see things here." And not the, you know, romanticized, idealized notions, colors, sounds, images, you know, fantastical. But this. And so he says, at this point, we can recall that story beginning with the child who strays into the woods. I think of Evelyn Underhill in her book on mysticism, talking about how the mystic path is a path where, in which we go into the wilderness, we go into the woods. And the fact that countless people have gone there before us is a good thing. Right? What a gift. Because they've left breadcrumbs, right? Signs along the way. How fortunate we are. But we've never been there. So for us, it's still a wilderness. And even in a trail that's marked with markers, we get lost, right? We can get lost. And so Dishan, called out by Zhu Feng, goes back to his room. And Zhu Feng calls his Dharma brother, Yanto, and tells him all about it. You can imagine his excitement. He turned back the old man. What's going on in his mind? Pride? Arrogance? Why did he need to tell this story? Who's it for? And so Yanto listens and says, "Ah, yeah. Great master though he is, he just hasn't yet grasped the last word of Zen." Well, you can imagine how that's going to get around. Right? The old man hasn't heard the last word of Zen. So what is Yanto doing? Right? And he said, "Yeah, you really did turn the old man around. Look at what you did." And so seeing the knot that Zhue Feng had tied himself in, Yanto tied another knot around him. Seeing a cage, as Dada Roshi used to often say, he built a cage, another cage. Let that pride grow a little larger. Let that tight knit get a little tighter. Sometimes that's what it takes for us to actually feel the confinement. When we see the confinement, then we might be ready. When we begin to meet the causes of our own constriction, our sadness, our anger, and we're finally ready to be done with it, to be free of it. It's that struggle that actually is quite important, quite necessary for us to really bring forth our wisdom, our efforts, our intention, our aspiration, our commitment. Buddhism really understands this very much. I was listening to an interview recently of Thich Nhat Hanh that had been replayed. It had been given some years ago. And in it, he was talking about suffering, and he said, personally, he would never want to go to a heaven where there was no suffering. Nor would he want to send anybody that he loved there. He said, suffering is how we learn to live this life. It's how we learn to develop our compassion, our understanding, our patience, our generosity. It's how we come to realize our self-nature. It's how we become free of our suffering. It's how we develop the capacity and the understanding and skillfulness to actually help others. It reminded me of many years ago. It's a long story, which we don't have time for. But I got swept away for a night with a group of people who seemed very nice, who invited me out to a country place. This is in California. I had actually gone out to look at schools and colleges, and sounded like a good idea. I wanted to get out of the city. Here was my ticket. I could spend a weekend in the mountains, California, before I needed to head back east. But I was suddenly in something that felt a little bit like an indoctrination. This is in the late 70s. And I found out later that it was the Unification Church, Reverend Moon, the Moonies. And they talked a lot about this world that they were creating that I could be a part of, in which there would no longer be suffering. And I was practicing already, but I didn't know very much. I didn't know much about Dharma. But even at that moment, at that time, I thought, I don't know. I just don't know if that sounds like a good idea, if that's a place I want to go to. I actually volunteered that opinion, which didn't seem to go very well with the plan. So Tishan calls Yanto in and says, "Don't you approve of me?" And Yanto whispers something in his ear. This is the second point of the koan. What did he whisper that satisfied Tishan? And he was quiet. What did he say? Of course we want to know. Are there secrets that are told that can't be revealed? This very interesting point of the koan. And the student needs to answer that question. What happened here? So Buddhism has a very profound understanding of the sort of machinations of our mind. And how, given sort of from that basic view of incompleteness, insufficiency, something is missing, something is broken, well, fill in the gap, flesh it out, make it complete. Right? That's basically the cycle of samsara, is trying to fix something that we perceive as broken. So, what's missing here? And so the mind that projects, that conjectures, that interprets, that interpolates, that fills in the missing pieces. Right? People who study the mind recognize that the mind creates mental maps. That's how we make sense of a world that is so filled with information. We reduce it down to these mental maps that then filters out stuff that we deem as unnecessary and allows in things that basically affirm the map. So once the map has been pretty well drawn, which seems to happen pretty early, it then goes looking for those things that belong on the map. And of course, the map is our sense of who we are. It's our sense of what the world is and should be. And so those things that we allow in are those things which affirm, in essence, this sense of me. Those things that are problematic are those things that don't belong on the map. So what did Yanto whisper? What did he say? The Buddha realized from the beginning that nothing is missing. There is nothing in excess, fundamentally, in the nature of things. Not knowing this, surveying the landscape, we see so much that is missing, so much that is in excess, that is so much of our own creation. Right? If we really understood, if we'd realized our Buddha nature, if we realized that everything fulfills itself, is complete within itself, without taking one step, not because of what it's achieved, but just by its very being, its suchness, then would there be a need for anyone to become a millionaire, a billionaire? to have more wealth than they could ever possibly count? Would we accept a society that needs poverty, that requires that there are people who don't have enough? So the next day, Dashaun went in to give a tesho. He took a seat, he gave a talk, and he says, sure enough, it was different from all the others. So Yanto stood up in front of the assembly, clapped his hands, and says, what a tremendous joy it is. The old man has finally grasped the last word of Zen. For now, nobody can make light of him. So what was different about the talk? This is the next point. What makes us Ananto Koan is it's just so activates the mind that wants to figure it out, that wants to fill in those missing pieces, that understands what's going on. I'll tell you, this is what Yanto said. This is what that talk was, how that talk was different. Right? The mind that imagines, that creates, that builds, that accumulates. Well, what else is there? Is there another reality? And what does all this have to do with today? What does it have to do with your life? You know, one way of looking at that is if we just observe and really see more and more clearly the sort of conditioned, habitual way that our mind works and the assumptions that it's built on, the assumptions that we have made, that we are basing our life on. And that's not always so easy to see. But they're displaying, the basis is always displaying itself through what arises within us. And importantly, the way we frame it, the way we rationalize it, the way we interpret it. And then we could ask the question, okay, so how's that working out so far? Right? Because if that was basically in alignment with how things actually work, it should be working out pretty well, wouldn't you think? Right? If you're playing a game and you really understand the rules of the game and you've mastered them and you've been honing them for the whole of your life, you should be pretty good at that game, wouldn't you think? And the evidence would be you're winning. You're winning. So that's a way of just looking at what's already there, right? The full evidence. We don't have to wait to fully understand the Dharma. Just look at the edifice that's been constructed so far. And so here he says, finally the old man has grasped the last word of Zen. So this is the sort of the deep point of the koan. What is that last word? The ultimate word, the absolute word, the ultimate truth. Right? We want to know the final answer, the key that unlocks every door, the insight that illuminates all the darkness. What is that truth? Right? How many stories have been told? Right? The Holy Grail, looking for that whatever, that thing, that knowledge, that answer, that insight. How do we seek it? How will we know? How can we be sure? Because of our grasping mind, what we see, and really, we begin seeing it from the very beginning, although we may not recognize it. If we really want to discover wisdom, the wisdom that lies within, we actually have to let go of all of the ideas we have of wisdom. Right? We tend to think that those ideas are going to steer us towards our goal. But those ideas actually obstruct our ability. That's the map. And so we really have to be very diligent, vigilant, I would even say, to see when those ideas arise and see them as ideas because we already have believed in them. That's why they're arising. And at that moment have more trust in the Dharma than in the belief and be able to let that go. And then we are, in a sense, taking one step closer. If we want to understand compassion, we have to, in our more direct practice, let go of our ideas of compassion. It seems counterintuitive. But that's because ultimately it's not something that we're going to figure out. And so that's why Wu Min says in the commentary, as for the last word, not Yanto, not Deshan, not even the Buddha has ever heard of it or seen it, even in a dream. And people will often see this, his comment, if I examine it carefully, it's like they're puppets on a shelf, as the enactment of this drama. And that's one way of looking at it. But there's something much more important going on. Why are they like puppets on a shelf? What does that have to do with the nature of self? What is the answer? What is the answer when it's not an idea or a word or a position or a thing? People often think of koans as a question that is bringing the person to an answer. And so we think of the answer as one of those kinds of things. It's not like that. It's not something you have ever even dreamt of. Or whatever we have dreamt of is not it. If you understand the first word, you'll know that the last word, first word, is not a word. Then what is it? That's why we are here in a training hall, sitting on a Bodhi seat, on a seat of no evasion, on a seat of breaking free of the tether of our conceptual mind. The conceptual mind is actually an important part of our practice. It's an important part, but we have to learn how to free it, liberate it, so that we're not trapped by it. We don't trap ourselves. And so Leon Lee, in his poem, continues. Wait for the sky's last blue, the color of your homesickness, then you'll know the answer. Wait for the air's first gold, that color of amen. Then you'll spy the wind's barefoot steps. Then you'll recall that story, beginning with a child who strays into the woods. The search for him goes on in the growing shadow of the clock. And the face behind the clock's face is not his father's face. And the hands behind the clock's hands are not his mother's hands. All of time began when you first answered to the names your mother and father gave you. Soon, those names will travel with the leaves. Then you can trade places with the wind. Then you'll remember your life as a book of candles, each page read by the light of its own burning. All of time began when you first answered to the names your mother and father gave you. In the teaching of dependent origination, name and form is when we come into being. We come into being as this person with the arrival of language, consciousness, physicality, thingness. And in the moment that we recognize, oh, I'm Shugen, all of time begins, the clock begins ticking, all forms of measurement, all ways of standing back and comparing and judging and saying, I'm this, I'm not that, have begun. And that it's not my father's face, my mother's face. It's not any such thing. Then we finally get to the point where we see those names traveling like the leaves, carried by the wind, right now, in every moment. The moment they arise, they're gone. Everything is impermanent. As Master Dogen said, life is moved through days and months and is hard to stop even for a little moment. When we try to ask, where did our youth go? We can't find any traces. And now, finally freed within that impermanence, within that selflessness, now we can be the wind. We're no longer bound by this body. We realize our nature and the nature of wind, the nature of leaves, the nature of names, the nature of concepts are all one nature. And then we realize that in all of the examples that we offer the world and that we see around us, the idea that we can act without consequence, or that we can hate someone else without hating ourselves, or that we can actually greedily find our way to contentment, that we can destroy life and liberty as a path towards freedom. We realize that not only are these not true, but they're dangerous ideas. Quite antithetical, quite contrary to life itself. In Buddhism, we call these delusions. Not seeing what's real, not understanding the basic nature of things, not able to live in harmony, not able to live a life of peace and joy. That's why the Buddha said trying to live by those ideas is impossible if we actually want to find fulfillment. And so, if we understand the first word and the last word is not a word, then we're stepping forward into non-attachment, into liberation. Dongshan commented on this and said, I am always most sincere right here. How beautiful. This truth that is not a word, is not an idea, is not something you can grasp, and is never apart. He says, I am always most sincere. Right here. May we all endeavor to that path, to be most sincere right here. To trust the one who does not know. To understand that when we conjecture, we're conjecturing. When we project, we're projecting. It's not the truth. Our mind is creating something. It might be skillful. It often isn't. Then we can remember our life. We can experience our life. Right now is a book of candles where each page is read by the light of its own burning. That each moment is illuminated by the moment that is no longer here. What a beautiful image. A book of candles, each page read by the light of its burning. And that its burning is its role, its place, its completeness. And so practicing non-attachment is not just, you know, doing what we should do because the Buddha said. But we realize it's coming into harmony with all things. It is the path of no conflict. It's difficult to let go of that grasping at knowing, right? We get so many rewards in our lives for having the answer, right? Like literal rewards, actual rewards, cookies, grades, money, adulation, position, power. And there is knowledge. There is knowledge that is, can be very powerful. They can open doors, unlock doors. But what we realize is, and what the Buddha taught is that we put unrealistic investments, we put unrealistic ideas and beliefs that aren't true. And we impute them into these, into this knowledge, into these ideas and concepts, into our identities, into the way we see things. And then something that is good becomes something that is binding. And so to practice letting go of that grasping at knowing, at knowledge, at having the answer, is really what we need to be practicing in Zazen. Every breath, and becoming really more and more astute at recognizing all the different ways that we are trying to locate, position, find some solid place, because we have this belief that that will give us some security. But when we look closely, we realize that makes us so precarious. Because that moment is only known through the candle that is burning that very page. That moment, it's gone. And so actually to begin to profoundly release into this not knowing, this non-grasping. Is the Dharma door. So, have a little faith. Have a little trust. Right? It's obvious that our mind knows how to grasp. That seems like an inherent, natural thing. It's a learned thing. But even more powerful is our mind's capacity to not grasp. Right? If we didn't already know that, we would have been buried a long time ago under the weight of all of our accumulations. So we already know it. But if we practice and make it strong, then that's something that we have to offer.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.